Is it time?
This is the My New Norm podcast, and I'm your host, Barry Scott Young.
And now, on with the show.
Now you can help support this podcast with as little as the price of a cup of coffee. Go to www.ki-fi.com/mynewnorm. Thank you in advance for your support and interest in this podcast. One more thing, help us get the word out by sharing this podcast with those you know. Please go to the show notes for more information. Now onto the episode.
I'm guessing you've heard the saying, everybody has a story, which is true, but the great thing about my guest today is that he's a gifted storyteller and communicator. Bob Cave is my longtime friend and guest on today's podcast. Bob grew up in a Southern California border town just two blocks from Mexico. He shares about his difficult childhood beginnings to his life today, which is full of healthy family, community, and fulfilling ministry. We share our love for authentic Mexican food in such detail that it makes you hungry. Bob is also a car guy, and if you know me, that's the cherry on top of this great conversation. Thanks for joining today, and I know you'll enjoy Bob's story. It's about real people and real stories. Well, welcome, Bob Cave. How you doing?
I'm doing great, man. Doing great.
You look great. Last time I saw you, I think it was around a conference table in Costa Mesa talking about youth camp that was going to start in a month, and we were wondering what to do.
I remember that. It was a great time.
Man, it's been a long time. Well, I'm so excited to share you with my listeners. Bob Cave is a veteran black belt youth pastor from the 1980s and 90s, and we were together sharing stories and sharing camps and kids. It's so good. I want to hear a lot of the missing pieces of your life. I don't think I know too much about your growing up. I know we were both in Southern California where we met, but you were there first. Why don't we start there, Bob? Tell us a little bit about growing up, where it was, what kind of kid were you, and maybe take it from there.
All right. Well, we were a Navy family, So we moved around a lot, but mostly in Southern California. I was born in Rhode Island, if you can imagine, on the water in Wickford, Rhode Island. We left there when I was about a year and a half old and headed toward San Diego. So we were up and down the coast of California. As a Navy family, we moved, like I said, a lot. So six of us kids, one was born in Kansas, one was born in Rhode Island, and the others were born in Long Beach and San Diego. And I was always the kid that got into things. I'm adventurous, always have been curious and adventurous. Wherever we were, I was the one that made friends first. My brothers were a little bit shyer and my sisters were little. So I kind of blazed the trail wherever we went as far as, meeting people and being a ringleader with kids. I loved our time in Southern California when we were younger. It was a wonderful time. And my dad was an alcoholic, as were a lot of Navy family kids. So every friend I had in high school, as a psychologist and pastor, and I look back on some of these things, every kid that I went to high school with that I was close friends with was a child of an alcoholic.
Really?
And statistically, they'll say if you're in a room of 100 people and there are 10 of you who are children of alcoholics, you'll find each other. Because you speak a similar, non-emotional, bottom-line kind of staccato language. And I found that true. All of my friends in high school were children of alcoholics. I'm still friends with many of them today. But that put a twist on our relationships in our family. We were very loyal. Mm-hmm. From an alcoholic family system, we're very loyal. But you live in a lot of denial, just like the alcoholic does. And we found out later that the 7 to 8 year old child of an alcoholic has about the same mature denial mechanism as the adult alcoholic does.
Oh, wow.
And so it was really interesting. And so I grew up really with being able to think real fast in crisis situations because we had crises all the time.
Do you think your adventurous spirit was a reaction to trying to escape the home life?
A lot of it was, I'm sure. But, you know, and I was the kid that was gone, you know, as soon as we left in the morning. If we didn't have school, as soon as I left in the morning, I didn't come home till the streetlights were on.
Exactly. That's how we played.
And it was safe, relatively safe from other people. And it was an amazing time in Southern California during that time. And we lived in Southern California. So I could see Mexico from our backyard. Tijuana was just a bike ride away. I crossed two streets to get to Mexico. We enjoyed it. And we never went through, you know, unless we were going with our parents, the border crossing. We just went through the holes in the fence. And just got tacos and played a little soccer down there and then went home. So we left a lot of canyons in San Diego. So we built a lot of forts, caught a lot of snakes and lizards and just we're down in that area all the time.
What were the Mexican restaurants that you always went to?
I started, my favorite Mexican restaurant in the world is called Las Cuatro Milpas. And it's in Barrio Logan, right underneath the Coronado Bridge. Still there today. If I go there to San Diego and don't bring tortillas home for my kids, home, Dad.
Oh my!
It is a very unique restaurant that serves was featured on Netflix, taco special. But
really?
They make everything fresh there. They make tortillas there, and it's not a show. Same ladies that have been doing it since I was in junior high, their daughters and granddaughters are there doing it now. So it's pretty fun. And then Roberto's. Was one of our favorites. So we had a couple of mom and pops, and then every other friend I had, you know, mom cooked Mexican food like you couldn't believe.
Right.
You know, my mom was Midwestern girl, and her tacos were really not tacos.
Velveeta cheese.
Exactly. Always Velveeta. You know, ground beef, and the tortillas were soggy.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, there's no Mexican food like San Diego, but we miss authentic Mexican food.
Well, I've been here in Kansas now for 31 years, and being here this long, they had one Mexican food restaurant that I thought was authentic, downtown Kansas City, nothing locally. And, of course, now we have some very good authentic Mexican food here. A lot of pretenders, but we do have the real deal. First restaurant we went to, they said it was Mexican food, but it was cafeteria style, and they were blending the beans.
No.
They blended the beans. So, no, they're refried, not re-blended. Come on. And we walked in, and my daughter was 15, and my daughter looked at the food, and she goes, "No, Dad, no.
No."
No. We walked out.
Growing up, Bob, do you remember when you were playing, were you always on a bike or were you walking or were you on a skateboard? What was your mode of transportation?
Yeah, we were always on a bike or a skateboard. I still ride both today. You know, I've got several longboards, and you know, at my age right now, my kids are very protected, so I look like a goofy old guy out there because they make me wear a helmet. I've had two brain injuries. The last one was on a hoverboard. So, they make me wear a helmet on everything. They're now onto elbow pads and knee pads. And so I'm like, you know, just not as fun as it used to be. Just going to, going down. We had a hill in National City called the S Hill. And it was a really challenging one to go down on a skateboard, especially when your wheels were either metal and then clay, and then polyurethane, we could have been okay. But the clay wheels, it was hard going down the S Hill. But
every bump, every rock, you would fly.
Yeah. So that was, I still have a video of my brothers and I on a skateboard. My brother took when we were probably 17, 18 years old. And my four brothers and I, it's really fun. But yeah, those are our memories. In the canyons a lot. You ride your bikes in the canyons. You know, you ride your skateboards all over. Go to the beach. You know, we made surfboard racks in metal shop for our bikes to ride our bikes to Imperial Beach, which is our closest beach. You know, and once in a while we'd stray out to OB or Mission Beach or Ocean Beach. And so that was a great time. You could, from our house, we were on the hill in Chula Vista, you could see the bay area, and then but you had to go either the Silver Strand Road, which is a long road to get to Coronado, or you could go to Imperial Beach on your bike. So
I see.
We weren't always close to a beach that you could ride your bike, but when we were, we spent a lot of time there.
Thinking about your growing up, what do you think are some of the most difficult or challenging times that you experience, but today you look back and those are the incredible things that helped you become who you are today?
So in our backyard, we had a lot of folks coming up from Mexico, coming into the United States. And my mom, we had fruit trees in our backyard. My mom had planted those and loved those. And we would always have people through the day or night that would come through our property. And we were just a neighborhood, you know, cookie cutter neighborhood. But in the back of our neighborhood was a hill with what we call pickleweed. And they would come in and take fruit from our trees and always leave something on the table for us.
Really?
They would always leave like a knife or nail clippers or a package of T-shirts or underwear that they had bought and left. They always left a gift, you know. Mm. And so my mom had one of our Latino neighbors write out a sign that said, please take as much fruit as you want and don't leave anything. This is our
don't.
Yeah. And so going down to Mexico, I began to see poverty. And of course, we were a poor Navy family. My dad was a boatswain mate, you know, his whole career, 28 years as a boatswain mate. And that's a lower, you know, rank and lower scale and with six kids on a Navy salary, my mom was a stay-at-home mom, which every mom was.
You're right.
Except my best friend's mom. She worked, and she was an anomaly in our neighborhood. But we were poor. We helped each other out. You know, nobody was on their own. You know, my friends, when they get in fights with their dads, would come stay at our house. Yeah. My mom was a neighborhood mom. She pulled stitches out. You know, she pulled splinters out. She, you know, pulled teeth. You know, she was just everybody's favorite mom. And this Dave was just everybody's favorite mom. And so our house was, you know, inundated with our friends in and out. And so, you know, having that closeness and that camaraderie and having that community, especially in a Navy housing, like we lived in Treasure Island. So you're on this island in the middle of the Bay of San Francisco. And that was the first year they had dependents, kids living on the island. And so we got in a lot of trouble, but we all did it together. It was community. So When I began in ministry, my youth groups were always very close to each other. Our peer groups, my youth group peer groups was the youth group. It wasn't their school. It was our peer group was our youth group in every church I've been to. And I was a youth pastor for 24 years. And I still have tons of connections. If I go to San Diego, I have people in my youth group meeting me there. If I go to Los Angeles, we'll have 45 to 50 kids and their spouses show up to just hang out because we're still friends. I've dedicated their babies. You know, I married most of them, dedicated their babies, baptized, you know, their kids, and lots of different things that when we come out to California, there's always some other thing to do.
Right, right.
But it's wonderful. And that community is what really formed in me growing up, becoming a Christian, finding out what that was like. And that was a whole new world of things, because we were a secular family. Our church was going every Friday to the drive-in theater. That's what we did once a week. We never ate out at McDonald's. You know, that was the predominant restaurant. We didn't eat at restaurants. We couldn't afford to, even at McDonald's. 15-cent hamburgers, couldn't do it. You know, we just never did that. So we were very close, and a lot of my friends didn't do that. And so I think that really formed in me a closeness and a community. So the churches that I pastor here in Kansas, you know, we have four campuses. And the reason we have four campuses is because I want to know everybody. Mm-hmm. I want to be involved in everybody's life. I know everybody's car when they drive in. If someone gets a new car, I'm like, whose car is that? Who got a new car? I didn't even know. We're that close to each other. You know, I know their kids. Their kids, you know, are very special to us. And so, and you can't be a huge church, you know. You know, we'll be a 200-person church on one location, and 150 on another location, 100 at another location. And so, and we have that same DNA of closeness, of being in community in the body of Christ, which is just, you know, my favorite way of doing it.
Doing life together.
Absolutely.
Tell me more about Hit Ashbury. You know, doing a chat before we started recording, I found out that we were probably on the same roads. I grew up in the Bay Area, and you weren't far from me back then in the 60s. What was it like in the 60s when Haight-Ashbury was getting going, and it wasn't very far from you because you were in Treasure Island? So tell me a little bit about that.
So we were on the base, and it wasn't very much on the base. The base PX, or the Navy Exchange, was there. But if you wanted to get haircuts and you were in your, you know, you were in your teenage years, you didn't go to the Navy barber, because he had one cut that he knows, and that was not what we wanted at that time. So we would always go into the Haight to get our haircuts and buy clothes and some other things that the Navy base didn't have. And that was a cheaper, you know, area to shop in. It was always interesting. We loved it. I mean, we loved it. I loved it especially because I was, like I said, I was an adventurous kid. Mm-hmm. You can let me go in Haight-Ashbury, and I would just find friends and people. And that during that time, back to the community thing, it was all community. Every hippie that was there, every person, you know, they were all like, hey, little dude, what's going on? You know, they were just, you know, want some of this, you want some food. It was just great. My dad didn't like it. I mean, he would roll down his window and yell for a half an hour to get haircuts. And your mom's, you're a disappointment to your mom. You know, the same things he always told us, you know.
Yeah.
He brought it to the wider community. But yeah, it was a really wonderful time, free time, a time where you didn't have a lot of structure. You just kind of, you know, free flowed. You just you're very comfortable with not knowing what's going to happen and what's going to, you know, the next hour, the next half an hour, who you're going to meet. It was a great time. And then we go back to the base, to military structure. Mm-hmm. So if you can imagine being a kid, you know, we had air raids on Treasure Island all the time, go down to the bomb shelters. And these guys were serious. These were not like teachers. I went to Treasure Island Elementary School in its first year of having an elementary school. And so all of these guys were, I mean, we settled our fights in the gym boxing. You know, if you got in a fight at school, you went to the gym. And I was very small, but I was scrappy. So they began to, one of the guys there, Billy, that ran the gym, he would say, hey, Bobby, pick on someone big that you know you can beat and get in the fight. And then when you guys come here, we'll bet on them. We'll bet on you to win the big guy. And you'll beat him, and we'll give you a dollar.
A dollar.
A lot of money back then. I was like, yeah. So I'm finding some soft big guy and punching him. And But it was an interesting mix because it was military base, so very structured. And that's Treasure Island. And the island it's connected to is Yerba Buena Island, which is the big hill that you see when you come across the Bay Bridge. And that big, and that was an open area of just having a blast. And so you got a little bit out of there. Then you went to San Francisco, and we didn't go to any areas that were, you know, well-to-do. We went to the Haight, and we would just have just an adventure. It was not the same as the military island.
My listeners may not know, but living on Treasure Island is a small area, and right to get there and to leave there basically is the Golden Gate Bridge. Isn't that right?
No, it's the Bay Bridge.
Oh, it's the Bay Bridge.
The Bay Bridge that goes to Oakland.
Okay.
So we're right between San Francisco, on the other side of San Francisco from the Golden Gate Bridge. And then you go on the Bay Bridge to the first stop could be Treasure Island.
If you were
Navy personnel. And then you go on to Oakland.
Okay.
So we were surrounded in water. It's a very small island. You could walk from one side to the other in about 10 minutes. And then you had the mountain of Yerba Buena Island that was the natural island. This Treasure Island was built in like the 1900s as an exposition, a World's Fair.
Oh.
So that was filled in there. And now it's privatized. They're going to be building condos and houses. It's no longer a government island. But I woke up every morning. If the fog wasn't there, I could see the Golden Gate Bridge and I could see Alcatraz from our window. And without outside, I could shoot a basketball into the bay. We had a chain link fence, which didn't keep any kids out. But
yeah. Well, I'd love to talk a little youth pastor stuff. When I met you, it must have been 79, 80-ish, mm-hmm. right in there. Yeah. We were in different locations. But when I met you, it was because of a district camp or activity. And I fell in love. It was like my brother from a different mother.
Yes.
And I think that relationship is still evident today. But when we were doing youth ministries together, what was it like for you at that time? When you think back of those years, what comes to mind?
May I start with my salvation, which is a couple of years before I was a youth pastor?
Yeah.
So I got saved in the Jesus Revolution, 1971. I got saved at a church where a pastor in Chula Vista, where I was living, and that's my hometown, and my family still lives there today. When I became a Christian, I went there because a girl that I liked asked me to go. I'd never been to church in my life. We had no understanding of what was going on, and I walked into about 70 people, and they're a pretty exciting group of people. But I was just waiting there with this girl, and I was in the back, and I remember I had my Chuck Taylors on, and I was tying them a lot because I had tears in my eyes, and I had not cried for years. And if I ever cried in front of my alcoholic father, you got beat. You got called names, you know. He'd come out with one of my sister's dresses and say, maybe you should wear this. I mean, it was just terrible. Crying was a new thing for me. And the pastor was talking about why Jesus died on the cross. I had no idea. All my friends were Catholic, so I knew Jesus died. He's on the cross in every house.
Right.
I remember asking, what did he do? You know, what did he do? I don't want to do that because this is serious stuff. Became a Christian that morning, and it absolutely changed my life. I was an angry child because being a child of an alcoholic, I was in fights all the time. From junior high to high school, they said, if you want to go to our high school, you have to enroll in wrestling because you have too much aggression. And I did have a lot of anger. I was red-haired, freckle-faced, little, 89-pound, 4'11", 16-year-old in high school. And I mean, I was in fights all the time. I never won any, but I was in fights. I was in fights all the time. And I just remember it being such a difficult time. When I became a Christian, I believed it right away. You know, as a child of an alcoholic, you have a lot of black and white thinking. You have a lot of all or nothing thinking. And so I had a lot of all or nothing thinking. And so I got into it. I was all in the same day. I never even heard anybody ever use any of the gifts of the Spirit. I was the first person I ever heard do that. And it wasn't frightening at all. It tickled me. It tickled. I was at the altar, and it was kind of like in the movie Elf when he burps really loud and he says, "Did you hear that?" You know, that's what I was like. Did you hear that I was doing there? So it was really interesting, but it was like gloriously saved. I mean, all in, and that was 16 years old. At 17, the next year, out in Jamul, California, we had a Christian youth camp that was run by a church out in El Cajon. I got called to the ministry on a rock there. We were sent away to pray, and I went away to pray, and I felt the Lord calling me to ministry. I put a fleece before the Lord the next week, which I didn't know you shouldn't do too much, but I did. And it was one of those scary fleeces where it happened exactly as I asked the Lord to do it. It freaked me out because it was so specific. And I started working at our church as a volunteer. Now, if you remember, and maybe some of your listeners don't know this, but in the early mid to late 70s, was really the first generation of youth pastors that felt called to be a vocational youth pastor. Right. Before that, in the Assemblies of God, where I became a Christian, we had Christ ambassador sponsors and CA presidents. And the sponsors are usually some kid's mom and dad that would kind of watch over us. And the sponsor would do that. And then the CA president would kind of do some of the activities. And they were generally one of the older kids in the group. But we didn't really have a youth pastor. And when God called me to be a pastor, he called me to be a youth pastor. And so over 24 years, I put every egg in that basket. I studied adolescence. I studied childhood development. I studied culture. And I became a student of youth ministry and youth culture. And I found out again that through my culture of community, that's what I needed to build.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we had few full-time youth pastors. You know, there were some bigger churches like the church that you were at, Barry, where they had a full-time youth. One of the first full-time youth pastors in probably San Diego County was Faith Chapel or San Diego First, and one of those big churches. Our churches, you know, I made $30 a month, and my sister made $35 a month watching the kids in the nursery. So
wow.
So when I was 17, got called into ministry, our custodian at our church, he had a cleft palate, was made fun of at school by all of us early on. He bought me my first Life of Christ book, which was at that time our Berean School of the Bible. He bought it for me and said, "I want to invest in your life." And he bought me two or three of those books. And he's my hero today, Bill Amon.
Wow.
And he saw something in me. My pastor saw something in me. My friend, who was our sponsor, Chet Kasotis, saw something in me and began investing in me in that way. When I was 18 years old, 2 weeks out of high school, I left San Diego, moved to Los Angeles to become a full-time youth pastor there, and at a church in Covina, California, Glendora. And so that was, again, part of my journey. I moved back a year later after college at Azusa Pacific College. I went there for a year on a wrestling scholarship and a track scholarship. Went back to Chula Vista and then became the youth pastor of the church I got saved at. And it was, you know, again, back to community, back to building friendships. And we had fun.
Yeah.
You know? And I mean, I remember one time everybody was late to a Wednesday night, and I'd read somewhere that, you know, if they don't respect you, they'll be late, you know, so you need them to respect you. And so I was trying to do a respect thing. So at 7:10, there really were only a couple of kids. So I canceled youth group and I said, "All right, we're done." So I went to my mom's house and I started watching a TV show called Beretta. It's an old, old cop show. Don't do the crime if you can't do the time.
Oh, and, my.
I was sitting there and my phone rang, and it was our big dining room phone with the big long cord, and picked it up, and it was my pastor, Don Gregg. He said, "Bobby, what are you doing?" I said, "I canceled it. I told him you guys can't get here on time. we're done. I'm teaching him a lesson. He goes, get your butt back here right now. So I came back and we did the last half of youth service, and I made a lot of mistakes like that. You know,
man.
Can I tell a story here?
Yes, yes.
So one of our pastor had a friend, and I can't really have told this story for years, so it might be a little embellished, but the bottom line was, I remember one of our members was a police officer, and he was going to do some training on how to corral a group of youth together. And so we were out playing volleyball every Wednesday night before we went in. And his plan was to come early, set up some cameras, and then train his guys how to corral us into a small group without anybody getting away. And that was what we were going to do for him in his video training video he was making. So I tell stories, and I told a story to the kids that there is a group of people who dress like police officers, and they're not police officers. They're white slavers.
Oh, my.
And they're going to take us to Mexico if they catch us. So if you ever hear me yell the word slavers, I want you to run away as fast as you can. Now, these are all Chula Vista kids, okay? They're all rough and tough kids. So we're out there playing volleyball, saw them start setting up, and two police cars drove up, and I just yelled, slavers! And everybody took off in every direction running. They corralled two girls. That's all. The rest of us were home free. You know? Of course, I got in trouble for that, too. You know?
So
that was a fun that we had. And that was, you know, we told stories that were fun and exciting for the kids. And we just did a lot of fun stuff. But that was my career. And that was as we began becoming more and more able at our youth ministry jobs, we're more proficient at it. We started going to other churches, and we could move from our home church to another church. And I went and moved again back to Los Angeles with my pastor that I worked with for 16 years in two different churches, and was a youth pastor there in Alhambra, California, Bethany Church. Loved that.
Yeah.
And that's we did a lot of camp and things together in those days. But my San Diego days were my favorite days. It's my hometown. It's where I met, you know, and have the relationships as well as my LA relationships in the same way.
Yeah.
But youth ministry was all I ever wanted to do. And when I came here to Kansas, I was a youth pastor for 4 years at the church I'm at now. And then I was sitting in my office one day, and I folded up my notebook on a retreat we were getting ready to do. And I folded up the notebook and I said, okay, it's all done. I said, Lord, I ask your blessing upon this retreat we're going to do. And the Lord said, am I invited on this retreat? And I said, well, of course, you're the guest of honor. He said, well, it's interesting that you've been planning this and writing this and putting it together for the last week, and you haven't asked me one time what I should do. What would you like me to do, Lord? I said, well, God, you know, you've been blessing me and helping me all these years, and you've trained me and equipped me. I didn't want to bother you with this. You know, you got pestilences and, you know, earthquakes to deal with all over the world. I got this. He said, well, if you can do this by yourself without me, then you're done. This is your last retreat. And he said, you're done with youth ministries. And I was like, no way. That's all I know. He said, it's not all you know. Everything that you do in youth ministries translates to senior pastoring. And I did not want to do senior pastoring. I had to worry about light bills and, you know, paying the bills and all this kind of stuff that I work with my pastors on. And so within 2 months of that, I was pastoring the church that I was youth pastor in. Our pastor resigned, and they wanted me to be the pastor. And so for 31 years, that's what we've been, 27 years now as senior pastor, that's what we've been doing. And, you know, it's been wonderful.
Wow. Well, there has been a lot of excitement in Kansas City.
Hurts has all day. Now some rushers come. Going to throw it as far as his arm can take it, which is well short. And the Kansas City Chiefs have won Super Bowl 57.
Did you see that coming?
Yes.
You did.
We so growing up, my mom and dad are from Kansas City, Missouri. It has nothing to do with why I'm here. I mean, zero. I mean, we don't, I have relatives here. I hardly ever know them or see them. But my mom and dad were Kansas City Chiefs fans. When we came to San Diego, San Francisco, we were either the kids, we were Raiders fans. Mm-hmm. And my mom and dad were still Kansas City Chiefs fans. They kind of liked the Chargers. We were in San Diego too, but they were worse than the Chiefs.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, coming back here, you know, I started following the Chiefs. We're 25 minutes from the stadium here. So we'd go to games when we could, mostly preseason or games that were on Monday night or Saturday. And the Chiefs were, you know, a mediocre team for those years. And then really when we got Joe Montana, that kind of sparked a lot of interest, you know, for a little while. And then it kind of waned a little bit. But then when Andrew Reid came, and of course Patrick Mahomes, we had Alex Smith, who's a very proficient quarterback, and we were getting to the playoffs a little bit. That was exciting.
Right.
And then we had Mahomes, and I've never seen a football player like Mahomes, a quarterback like Mahomes. I've never seen anybody like him. His creativity on the field, what he does, his ability. He was a baseball player, so he can throw a sidearm football, underhand football. He's just amazing to watch, and the nicest kid that you see around town. He's got great charities. You know, he just really is the nicest guy. He, you know, he gives glory to God a lot, as a lot of football players do. But you kind of believe a little stronger with him because he talks about it a lot. We watch him. He hasn't done this yet, but we watch him doing a behind the back pass in practice. Back pass so hard. So we had a video just we saw the other day. He's throwing a football with his right hand and hits a crossbar of the goalpost. He throws a football with his left hand, hits the goalpost, the crossbar of the goalpost. He throws it behind his back with speed and hits the goalpost upright. The crossbar. It's unbelievable what he can do. So with him, everybody's been hopeful. So, you know, they've been into the playoffs every year since he's been here. We've been to 3 Super Bowls. We lost one, 1-2. So you kind of see it coming here. You kind of expect something magical to happen with him and Kelsey and Tyreek and those guys.
Well, his offense is so creative, like you said. It's almost, to me, it's almost like playing football on the streets. You hike the ball and you say, go for it, get clear, I'll find you.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what it looks like. Yeah. Well, it's like, ready, go, get clear, you know.
That's what
Travis get open.
Yeah, Travis Kelce says, hey, I go out there, he's running to the right, I go find a space.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to watch. And we enjoy it. It's a blast.
Well, I would love to talk some VW.
What is it?
It's a 200-year-old Volkswagen. They really built these things, didn't they?
I'm a car guy. I know you are too. Your love for VWs, where did that start? What have you had? What do you have now? And what have you done with them?
Well, it started in San Diego, of course. And you remember, Bear, that's, you know, there were so many Volkswagens on the road in the 60s and 70s. I mean, it was just,
yeah,
because it was, you know, it was a poor community. That's all we could really afford. Easy to work on. And we were close to Tijuana. So if you needed to fix it, you could go to Tijuana. You can get body work done. You know, I had a side business, right? I was 14 years old driving people's car. I advertised in the Penny Saver. I would drive their car. I advertised mobile upholstery. And my mom would drop me off at somebody's house. And I would go in there and get their bug. 14 years old, no license. I did have a Navy ID card that's very official. And I would drive across the border with no insurance, no license. I would get the entire inside of a Beetle done for $75 and charge them $125 and eat tacos all day, go to the bullfight, go to the beach, pick up the car, drive it back there, have my mom come pick me up when my work was done. She thought I was doing yard work. So that was one of my first businesses with Volkswagen. My grandson, we have a business called O-Town VW. You know, Lathe is where we live, so we just call it O-Town. And we just piddle with stuff. But we buy and sell bugs, fix them up, buses. But in San Diego, that's where my love of Volkswagens came in. Because we were also near canyons, we could Baja them. So my brother-in-law and I had a business where we Baja'd people's bugs for them. But we had every type of beetle, bug, thing. The VW thing was one of my favorite.
Yeah.
You can beat that thing up. It's like an American Jeep, but it's a German Jeep.
Correct.
We had Carmgias. We had Type 3, which is a little station wagon. But bus was my favorite. And we owned a bus. And one of our social studies teachers said to us one day, he says, hey, you know, because we knew we were surfers, he said, you know, you guys could, this is one of the few places in the world where you can surf and ski, snow ski in the same day. He said, you go up to Big Bear, you could be there, you know, in a couple hours and surf in the morning and go ski in the afternoon. So that's what we did. So at least twice a year, we loaded up our bus and we all had made surfboard racks for inside and outside our bus. We had no regular Volkswagen seats in our bus. We had bean bags. And we get in our bus, about 7 to 8 of us, head up to, you know, go surfing in the morning and leave there, go up to Big Bear, ski for that afternoon, come back that night and have a, you know, a hot dog roast on the beach and just enjoy living in Southern California. It was a wonderful thing. But so the love of Volkswagens, the adventure of it, all the hippies that had Volkswagens, what they did to them, how they did their decorations, and you know, I mean, when we need a new Volkswagen for our bus, we just stole one. We just went somewhere where a car's parked in some business that's going to be there for a while, and we just undid 2 or 3 bolts, a couple of cables, and the engine came out in about 6 minutes.
And we
sometimes put our engine in and replaced it and then kept theirs, or sometimes we just kept the engine and toasted ours out. But yeah, so it was interchangeable parts. We loved that. We were hoodlums with our VWs for a while. And then after I became a Christian, that all stopped. We used to smuggle parrots from Tijuana to San Diego.
What?
Yeah. So parrots in Mexico, you can buy them for like $20. And you can bring it up to California, to San Diego, and they'd sell for like $150 to $200.
Oh.
So the guy that owned the pet store in Imperial Beach told us how to take a little drop of tequila with an eyedropper, give it to the bird, they'll be quiet, wrap them up in like a snow cone. You wrap them up like a snow cone, and you put the head sticking out, and you hide them all in your bus everywhere. And so we'd probably bring back 15 birds, 12, 13, 14, 15 birds. And we made pretty good money doing that for a little while. And then we had a smell in our bus. For like a week, we couldn't figure it out. We forgot one of the birds.
Oh no!
And it died and started decaying in our bus. But finally found that. But yeah, so that's where my love of Volkswagens came from. Our friends and family community always having them around. They were, and you know, you could help somebody fix it if you knew a little bit about mechanics.
Right.
I knew very little, but I could, you know, I could help them with their, you know, their fan belt or something that they needed. But
kind of V-dubs do you have or had? Looking at your social media, you seem to always have at least one bus.
Yeah, I have right now I have 3 buses of different kinds. 3 buses. I have 2 Beetles. I have a single cab, which is a bus truck, a 63 single cab. We went to Chip Foose's garage.
Yeah.
So Chip Foose is a pretty big name, and Overhaulin' was his show.
Yeah.
And we went to take a tour there. My buddy that owns a Volkswagen shop here, he's 70 years old. On his 70th birthday, he wanted to go to see the people that he's been buying parts from.
Yeah.
And so I said, went to Pierside Parts. And I said, hey, you know, Chip Foose's garage is here. Let's see if we can get a tour. So we went to Chip Foose's garage, and the tour guy was at lunch, but Chip Foose walked by and said, can I help you guys? Oh, well, we were hoping to have a tour. It's my friend from Kansas City. He's been buying Volkswagen parts for 40 years, and we just wanted to. He goes, well, I'll give you a tour, I guess. So Chip Foose gave us a personal tour for over an hour of his cars. On the way out, there was a converted Type 3, which is a little station wagon, that him and his dad, Sam Foose, who is also an auto designer, they chopped that up to make it like an El Camino, a real tricked out El Camino. And so Chip bought that back a few years ago and was going to make it a shop truck. And he had been doing all kinds of things. So it had Porsche rims on it. He had fanned out some of the wheel wells and put a really nice fuel injected engine in it. And the interior was the guy that did his overhaul and interiors, and it was worth about $6,000. If you were to do it, it'd be about $6,000 worth of upholstery work, all leather, beautiful. So I asked Chip, I said, hey, what are you doing with this Volkswagen? And he said, I'm selling it. I said, well, how much do you want for it? He told me. I said, all right. I said, I'll give you some money now. We'll come back in a couple of months and haul it home. So I also have that one with my buddy and I own it together. So we have that Type 3 that we're looking to sell. We had Chip sign the inside of the glove box and get a bunch of pictures with us and tell us some stories about it. So and I have a Volkswagen thing. Right now we have a Kansas City Auto Museum. It's Volkswagen month. So I have a 73 Volkswagen thing with a trailer that folds out to be a picnic bench. And a place to sit at car shows, and I have a 68 Volkswagen Bug that we bought in Chula Vista. My brother and I did a few years ago. It still has the California tag 68 Vocho, which is slang Spanish for bug. I like that so much. So my brother and I are co-owners. So I register in California, although it's here.
Right.
I have a 66 bus, passenger bus. I have 5 grandkids. Every Friday of their entire life. The oldest is now 17, but since he was a baby, we tooled around every Friday in the bus. Friday was called Papa Day, so all of them grew up in the bus. We drove the bus from here to Chula Vista one year with my brother and my daughter with us, so all of us in a bus, no air conditioning. Holtville was 110 degrees when we hit it at 10 o'clock at night. 110 degrees in a Volkswagen. But as long as you're moving, you got wind and you got air.
That's
coming
right.
Through those drafts. So,
how many miles was that trip?
That was 1,600 there. So 3,200 miles. I had to get the heads tightened in Albuquerque. And then I had the heads redone in Chula Vista. The way back, we stopped in Albuquerque, make sure everything was going. And we really had no issues. We didn't break down, not once. So it's great. And then I have a 72 camper bus called Westfalia, or a Westie, and Campmobile. And my wife and I have taken that to New York and up through Niagara Falls into Canada, all around, back down, another 1,600 mile each way journey. But we camped in the bus. We were gone 2 weeks, and we camped in the bus for 8 days of those. And every once in a while, we at a hotel with showers and stopped at gyms and, used the day pass for $10 and took showers. But yeah, it was great. So we've adventured in these. I drove the thing from California to here. We just travel a lot and go to car shows in Arkansas and down in San Diego and go to the bridge, Arizona, different places for car shows. And I have one car that wins awards. It's the thing. It wins awards, but it's still a driver, a daily driver. Everything else is a daily driver. 63 single cab right now we're working on. It's down to what we call the bones. So the bone structure is just showing. That one will be more of a show bus because we're having to just strip it down completely. We call it Frankenstein because it looks like pieces from everywhere you can think of going on it. So I found a Frankenstein shifter that we're going to paint up and put on my shift knob. So that's going to be Frankenstein.
Is that the year where you take out the motor and the back tires look bull-legged?
Most of the time, but the single cab is the worst because it's the lightest with the back bed. The bed is 8.5 feet long by almost 5 feet wide, and the tailgates and the gates fold down, so it makes like a flatbed or a truck. And it's got a seat for three people in the front, and that's it. So yeah, that one's really pricey because they're rare.
Sure.
They have a storage underneath called treasure chest drawers. Mine has two treasure chest doors. But those will, you know, it'll probably cost me $30,000 to fix it up, and it's probably worth about $55,000 when it will be done.
Probably so more, I would think.
Yeah, they're crazy with. We bought them for $200. We bought bus for $200.
Right, and drive them home.
Yeah, now to get a bus without much rust, you're looking at for anything in the 60s, 68 below, you're looking at something around, you know, $25,000 for one that just has a little bit of rust. But yeah, so I love, and I have, I mean, I'm crazy Volkswagen stuff because it's very nostalgic for me, very family oriented. So I have Volkswagen art. I also collect art, you know, here and there. So I have a lot of Volkswagen art from all over the world. My grandson and I, in August of last year, went to the Volkswagen plant in Wolfsburg, Germany.
Really?
They are living for 2 years in the Netherlands. And so it was a 4.5 hour drive to Wolfsburg. We drove there in an Audi on the great highway freeway system they have there. And it was just a blast. But the World War II plant, the original Volkswagen plant, is still there. And it's the largest plant in the world. And it's still in use. They built a phenomenal auto museum right next to it, the Autostadt Museum, where they have the last Volkswagen made and produced with one of the first Volkswagens that Ferdinand Porsche actually drove there in that museum. So it was incredible. And then we went to Hanover. After a few years in Wolfsburg, they made the buses in Hanover. So we toured the Hanover plant and looked at all those. And that's where they're making the new ID Buzz Volkswagen bus electric.
Oh, okay.
So we got to see those. And so, yeah, so my love for Volkswagen goes to the origins of Ferdinand Porsche. We try to stay away from the origins of Hitler, but...
I was going to say that.
Yeah, it was Ferdinand Porsche that built the engine. And he actually borrowed that from several other folks that were producing cars, because we've seen some old cars that look just like Volkswagens, but they're not Volkswagens.
Right.
But he designed the engine, opposable pistons, and it's a phenomenal engine. I bought a bus that hadn't been run in 16 years. Hadn't been started for 16 years. We just changed out the gas lines, got some new gas, put a new battery in it, cranked it 3 times, and it started. I just had to rebuild the carburetor.
Oh my!
Carburetor, and it ran. It's unbelievable. These things are hardy, and that's what Porsche wanted him for. But yeah, so I collect some Volkswagen memorabilia. I have art all over my house. I probably have 150 little model buses all over my place. My wife is very tolerant.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you sharing that story for sure. Where did the nickname Caveman come from or start?
Well, you know, when your last name is Cave and you're in elementary school, it's always a part of it. It got to be Caveman forever. Then it was Captain Caveman when Captain Caveman was on TV.
That's right.
Yeah. So yeah, most of the time it's just Caveman. And my wife 1 year bought me a license plate say Caveman. So that was her personalized plate. So those are on, you know, in Kansas you only have to have license plates on the back. So a lot of my buses have Caveman on the front. That's how people know me. And I got her a Cave Woman license plate. I told my son when he was about 20, that Cave Boy is available if you'd like it.
Of course, he's taller than you, right?
He just told me to be quiet. But so I was always Bobby. You know me as Bobby.
Right.
I was Bobby Cave forever. And then my son was Robert Mark Cave II, or Robert Mark Cave Jr. So he became little Bobby, and I was big Bobby. And then when he got bigger than me, he became Bobby, and I became Bob. So whenever I'm in anywhere around, if someone calls me Bob, they're my friends from Midwest.
Right,
if you call
right.
me Bobby, you're my friend from California.
That's right. Well, Caveman, I just can't believe how much time, number one, that we spent together at one time.
Yes.
And then how much time has gone since we have been together. And today's kind of that reunion for us. I wish we had more time together. I just wanted my listeners to know your story, and you sharing today, I know, is going to encourage people where they are. It's not how you started, it's how you finish. And you have been walking that road to finish well for a long time. But I really, really appreciate you, Bob. It's been great talking to you again.
Same here, Bear. We miss our times together, but like I was telling you earlier, it doesn't matter what decade we connect. We connect every decade, and time has not passed. We pick up right where we left off. We just always had fun together. And I loved your heart, heart for youth, your heart for innovative ministries always was there, Bear. You were kind of like our inspiration when it came to doing something new. You always seemed to be on the cutting edge of something. And we really appreciate that. You led the way in a lot of things, and we counted on you for that and still do.
Well, I appreciate it.
Thank you for the privilege of being a part of your podcast. I've enjoyed all the episodes. It's been really good.
It's been great talking to you, Bob.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode. Did you know that we are on Instagram and Facebook? Until the next episode, this is the My New Norm podcast. It's all about real people and real stories with your host, Barry Scott Young.